May it please the court, my name is Rachel Funes, attorney regulation number 41716, and I represent Mr. Prof. I'd like to focus my argument today on issue one in the opening brief, but if you have any questions about the other issues, please feel free to let me know. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Mr. Proctor had a BAC of 0.158 a little before 9 a.m. on the morning of his trial. His trial was nearly completed, except for closing arguments, by mid-afternoon that same day. The defense attorney and the district attorney both expressed concerns about Mr. Proctor's mental state and his physical condition. They both agreed that he had trouble walking, that his speech was slurred, and that he had spilled his water 3 times during voir dire.
Did the district attorney or the prosecutor said they agreed with the factual representations?
Correct.
They didn't specifically agree with each and every one of those, did he?
He just made a broad statement that he agreed with the factual representations made by defense counsel.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. Defense counsel also specifically alleged that Proctor was unable to understand everything that was happening and that he had been unable to assist in his defense and provide meaningful input during voir dire. This is the definition of incompetence. Competence is having the present ability to rationally and factually understand all the proceedings and a present ability to assist and consult with counsel. Due process provides both substantive and procedural protections when competence issues are raised.
Are they both necessarily invoked whenever a competence issue is raised?
My argument is that they are, Your Honor. Here, defense counsel specifically cited the due process clauses of both the United States and Colorado constitutions. And my argument is that due process encompasses both procedural and substantive concerns. And
there's no difference between procedural and substantive due process?
No, there's certainly a difference, but I don't think that, opposing counsel hasn't cited a case where any court has held that in order to preserve both procedural and substantive concerns, you have to say procedural due process and substantive due process.
Have you cited a case that says that, you know, just a due process claim alerts the trial courts to both aspects?
I have cited some cases where they talk about how it's intertwined, and when the issue is raised, the court has an automatic duty to make an adequate inquiry, which is the procedural due process requirement. And then substantive due process is also offended if the defendant is incompetent when he stands trial. So I think that the issues are so intertwined, and the court's duty becomes automatic once the issue is raised.
Counsel, before we leave the preservation issue, can I ask you, was the issue about the continuance preserved? No one actually asked the judge for a continuance, did they?
I do believe that defense counsel asked for a continuance. I think I have that cited in my opening brief in the preservation section. I'd have to look back at exactly what he said, but my recollection is that he said, I'm ready to go forward, but I don't think it's fair. So I don't know that the word continuance was actually used.
Well, again, is that enough to alert the trial court to the possibility that, Your Honor, a recess or a continuance overnight is all we need? Is that enough to alert the court to that's what you're asking for?
I think it is in this circumstance because, let me see if I can find a case. There was a recent case actually out of the Court of Appeals, People v. Nagy, 2014 COA 12, and it's at paragraph 15. And that court, or that case, said that even if no more than a doubt is entertained as to a defendant's competency, the court has a duty to suspend the proceedings. And I just think in this instance, when you raise the issue of competency, the court has a duty to suspend the proceedings at least long enough to make an adequate inquiry to determine whether the defendant is competent. And under these circumstances, a continuance would have been the best and easiest and most practical remedy because intoxication is a temporary problem that becomes less of a problem over time.
So there's not really an independent argument about the continuance. It's really part of the duty to suspend the proceedings.
Yes, and I think defense counsel's statement that he didn't think it was fair to go on with defendant in his current condition was sufficient to alert the court that a continuance would be an adequate remedy.
Okay.
Did trial counsel ask the lower court to do anything more than the colloquies that the court engaged the defendant in?
The trial counsel didn't specifically ask. Trial counsel raised the issue and asked the court to inquire, but I don't think he specifically said you need to inquire further, like those specific words, but he continued to object after the inquiry and say, I don't think it's fair. I don't understand why the court is not agreeing. He's clearly intoxicated. So again, I think that all of those objections and just raising the issue of competence was sufficient to alert the court to its duty to make a sufficient inquiry.
Well, what else could the court have done short of the continuance?
I think that the court could have made a more adequate inquiry into, he asked Mr. Proctor whether he understood the proceedings, and Mr. Proctor said yes. But he never asked specific questions to actually determine whether Mr. Proctor's understanding, his subjective view that he understood the proceedings, was actually a rational understanding of the proceedings. For example, he never asked, do you know what you're charged with? Do you understand what voir dire means? Do you understand what peremptory challenges are? Why you're...
And did counsel suggest those questions needed to be asked, or was counsel satisfied that the record was sufficient to show he's incompetent?
I don't know. I honestly can't answer that question because I'm...
And I've taken up a lot of your time on preparation, and I apologize.
No, that's all right. No problem. Going back to the what the court could have inquired further, I just wanted to refer the court to U.S. v. Williams, which is that federal case cited in the reply brief. It's a Tenth Circuit case. In that case, for example, the woman thought that her rights were being denied because her attorney wasn't interrupting the direct examination of one of the state's witnesses to ask his own questions. And so in that case, the defendant thought she understood what was going on. She thought her rights were being violated, and she was very upset about it. But yet her understanding of what was going on was not a rational and reasonable understanding of how a judicial proceeding is supposed to work. So that's just an example of how further searching inquiry could have determined whether Mr. Proctor actually understood or whether he thought he understood, that he was actually extremely confused.
Counsel, is the determination of whether a bona fide doubt, is that a reviewable under an abuse of discretion standard? How about this? Assuming it is reviewable under abuse of discretion standard, what are we to do under that standard when on the cold record the answers seem responsive to pertinent questions, and it's the trial court, not us, who observed his demeanor? What are we to do under an abuse of discretion standard?
Well, I think that, I guess I disagree with the factual assumption that his statements were somewhat responsive, but he was also somewhat off track. And I think under the current case law, for example, Jones v. District Court, the court has said that trial counsel has a better opportunity to observe and a better opportunity to know whether the defendant is actually capable of understanding and assisting in his defense. And so the court has to give great weight to the statements of trial counsel. And here trial counsel was saying, I'm not able to get any meaningful input from Mr. Proctor. I don't think he's understanding what's going on here. He's extremely intoxicated. So I think the court had a duty to give more weight to that statement by trial counsel. I also think that the court gave too much weight to Mr. Proctor's own assurances because it didn't ask more specific questions, and because Mr. Proctor, for example, said that he'd only had a couple of shots, which is clearly not true if his BAC is 0.158. So Mr. Proctor is clearly sitting here minimizing his level of intoxication and maximizing, overstating his ability to understand what's going on. And so I think under those circumstances, you can look at the record and determine that the court abused its discretion. And the court also...
You said that some of his answers were off track or off target. Which of his answers do you find working? I mean, the judge asked him, are you ready to go to trial? Yes. Are you able to understand what's going on? Yes.
Sure.
I've had a rough life, and I've had a few drinks. I've been around the block a few times. Yeah, except for the fact that he called the judge by his first name. I don't see anything.
well, that's one of the examples.
Yes, that's one. But it was his former counsel, so that's understandable.
Yeah, I mean, so the court asked him in the context of an inquiry into his intoxication, how are you feeling today, Mr. Proctor? And he says, well, I've been feeling pretty bad most of my life. That's a little bit off topic. And then Let's see, he says, like you said, he calls the judge by his first name. He goes on a tangent right after that saying, some things you get charged with just aren't right, and, you know, talking about the charges in this case, which isn't something that's being inquired into. And this is all pages 3 to 5 of the first day of trial. And then later on, let me see, I think there was one more example here. Later on, he interrupts defense counsel. This is on page 104, to argue with him about whether he spilled his water.
Someone say to correct counsel. Some could say he was correcting counsel as to his perception when he had done. What about the comment that he makes about, I respect both your judgment, Judge, and my counsel's judgment? Doesn't that suspect he's responsive and rational?
I'm trying to find, I'm sorry, I don't know where that was exactly. Oh, here it is, I found it.
I'm glad you did. I was hoping it was this case.
So actually the court had just asked him, were you able to communicate with your attorney? And he said yes, and then there was an exchange between the court and defense counsel. And then the court says, I'm asking him questions, not you, to defense counsel. And then the defendant says, Judge, it's like I said, I respect his judgment and yours. Again, it's kind of a non sequitur. It's not a response to anything that's been asked of him.
I mean, to find an abuse of discretion, I mean, wouldn't the defendant's responses have to be, you know, profoundly more irrational than the things you're pointing out?
I don't think so. I think that, I'm running out of time here, but I'll answer your question, and then I'm going to reserve the rest of my time. I think that in combination with defense counsel's statements, the objective evidence of his BAC, and the factual representations of both defense counsel and the district attorney regarding his intoxication, I think there's plenty of evidence here to find that he was substantially intoxicated and not capable of, not competent to stand trial. And I also think the court failed to make adequate findings, which in and of itself is an abuse of discretion. I'm going to go ahead and reserve the 2.5 minutes I have left. Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado on this matter. The defendant is presumed competent, and the defendant has a burden to prove that he was incompetent. Here, the trial court gave both the prosecution and the defendant the opportunity to present evidence and argument, considered all of the evidence and argument presented, and then found that the defendant was competent to proceed.
How about the issue about whether the circumstances raised a bona fide doubt requiring further inquiry into his competency?
I think that there, I guess I have two responses to that. One, I think that this situation didn't raise a bona fide doubt. But second, I think the court did make sufficient inquiry, even to assuming that there was a bona fide doubt raised, to constitute a sufficient hearing on the issue.
Well, let's talk about the bona fide doubt then.
Sure.
When the people's apparent agreement to the factual circumstances in and of itself create a bona fide doubt as to his competency?
My argument as to the bona fide doubt goes to the fact that he didn't present any evidence that he was suffering from a mental disability.
Is that your only argument, counsel?
My only argument as to bona fide doubt?
Yeah, is that your only argument that it was not a mental disability?
No, I wouldn't say that that's my only argument. I'd say that that's my first argument, is that this was not a mental disability, and I can argue further on that. And I think also that then in light of its inquiry, if there was any doubt, it was dispelled, and thus at the end there was no bona fide doubt as to the defendant's competency.
What do you do about the fact that he blew a .158 As I understand the record, just a few minutes before the judge or after the judge was making his inquiry, and the judge knew that, right? He knew that he was going to appoint 158.
That's correct. And
what did we do with that? And that, if he had been driving, he would have been in bigger trouble.
Okay. I believe he found the, he blew the 158. They had an initial inquiry before voir dire, and I think he in between that and then when they had the second inquiry after voir dire, which was then a couple hours later, that was when he did that. And I think the response to that is that there's no dispute that he was intoxicated here, but intoxication is not the same issue as incompetency. And there are a number of courts that have recognized that, and that you can be intoxicated and still be competent. And even I cited one case where the defendant had blown a .19 and the court found that he was competent to proceed because it's just a different inquiry. And that's not a, whether he's intoxicated is a factor, but not determinative of the competency question. Let's see. I think here the...
Let me ask you, what kind of circumstances would we have to override the trial judge's on-site observations based findings of either competency or some bona fide doubt as to competency? What kind of circumstances could override the trial judge's determination?
I think these are factual findings, and therefore you would have to find, well, you'd either have to find that the factual findings had no support in the record, they're clearly erroneous, and that the facts that were the case were then...
Are you saying that any time a judge asks the question, do you understand the proceedings, yes, can you help your lawyer, yes, are you saying that every time those questions are asked, that it's necessarily insulated from any kind of review or reversal, whatever the circumstances would be, as to the defendant's competency? Is that what you're saying? That the judge's questions insulates and answers would insulate any type of, any circumstance of reversal in that situation?
I am saying that there's a procedure here, and I don't know that I'd use the word insulate. The court makes factual findings, and then the first inquiry is, are those factual findings supported by the record? And if they are, then those factual findings are what this court should consider. Now, if it made factual findings, and then those factual findings...
He didn't make any findings, though.
Well, what the court did here is it did rule that the trial should presume. And this is like there's a case, let's see here. One of the cases cited out of the, let's see here, I think it's the 10th Circuit. United States versus Cruz addressed this similar situation. And this is United States versus Cruz, 10th Circuit, 781 F second 826. And it said, where that, like here, the defendant was ordered to stand trial, that we believe this constitutes a finding that defendant was sufficiently competent to understand the proceedings against him and assist in his own defense. So I think that's correct. That implicit in what the court did here was that he was finding that he was competent to proceed, and it was making those factual findings that the standard for competency were met.
Did you cite Cruz in your brief?
I believe so. I did not have that quote in the brief. But that is a case that certainly I'm cited in this proceedings.
Okay.
And I believe it's cited in my brief.
So let me return to my question, counsel. Is there any circumstance under which, any set of circumstances under which the trial court would have abused its discretion in finding no bona fide doubt as to competency when it says, ask those two questions and get those answers? Any set of circumstances.
As to bona fide doubt? There's just being a bona fide doubt?
Well, we'll go with bona fide doubt, then we'll go with you.
Okay. I think as to bona fide doubt, there could be a situation, and it would be, you know, if we had, and I think there's case law on this, like, you know, if the defendant had come in and he had a expert opinion by a psychologist or whatever, that he was suffering from a mental disability that prevented him from doing these things, from meeting the competency standard, that asking those two questions alone wouldn't be sufficient to dispel as a reasonable doubt, or a bona fide doubt in that issue. But I think that the facts here are very different from that. Particularly because intoxication is an issue that is within the normal range of people can give lay testimony on the issue of intoxication. It's not something that requires expert analysis like a lot of mental disabilities might require. Here, I think the court's findings are supported by the evidence. The defendant offered clear and coherent responses to the trial court's questioning. He repeatedly unambiguously stated that he could understand what was going on in the trial and that he wanted to proceed. He was able to recall the judge had represented him in a case over 30 years prior. He was able to remember the judge's first name and immediately recognized that his use of that first name was inappropriate in the current setting. He was able to recognize his counsel's arguments and object to them. There's no indication that he's in any way disruptive or incompetent during the proceedings after the trial court made its finding. And at the end of the day, the defendant confirmed that he'd been able to follow everything during the trial when the court inquired. He also personally affirmed that he agreed with defense counsel's decision to submit lesser non-included offenses. And then the next day, reaffirmed that decision when there's no suggestion that he was intoxicated.
And can we look at the evidence of his actions or lack of actions during trial as kind of retroactively reaffirming the either failure to conduct further proceedings or lack of a competency determination? Can you look at the inactions or actions at trial to confirm something?
I think that they confirmed that there was no need for any further inquiry. That the and confirm that the.
Do you have any authority saying we can look to the trial to give us backup for whatever position the trial court may have taken?
You know, I'm trying to remember the case. There is one of these cases. I believe it's in Mondragon, where they remanded, and it's part of the remand order. I'll have to make sure it's Mondragon. But there is one of the cases that they discussed that the court should consider all of the evidence of things that came afterwards.
For a competency determination.
Right.
So you're saying that by analogy, that suggests that the record then could support the trial court's determinations?
That's correct. I'm saying that the ultimate question here is whether the defendant was incompetent or not, and that in evaluating that decision, we can consider all the evidence that's in the record about that. Let me see here. I'd also note that I think defense counsel's assertions and allegations were also all addressed. Defense counsel alleged the defendant was having trouble walking and speaking, but the trial court rejected those assertions based on its own observations. He alleged that he could not get any meaningful input on which juror he should exercise a peremptory challenge on, but the defendant explained that he respected his attorney's judgment. He alleged that most of his notes to the defendant said quiet, but he didn't search all of them said quiet, and he admitted that they were communicating when the trial court asked him. And he alleged that he spilled his water 3 times, but the defendant noted that it was only a few drops. That in and of itself wouldn't indicate that he's incompetent. And notably, when the trial court inquired into the issue again at the end of the day, defense counsel did not indicate that there had been any difficulty communicating with the defendant during the presentation of the evidence. So I think because the court's findings here are supported by the evidence,
When you said at the end of the day, there had been no difficulty communicating during the presentation of evidence, I thought the second inquiry occurred before the trial actually started.
Okay, so there were three inquiries. There would be the first inquiry was that was before any trial had started, and the court talked to the defendant. Then there was an inquiry after voir dire when the court ruled it was competent. Mm-hmm. And then there was a third inquiry after the presentation of evidence when the court was doing its Curtis advisement, and they were also talking about the lesser non-included offenses, and defense counsel requested with regards to the lesser non-included offenses that the trial court inquire in about the defendant because they were getting a waiver from the defendant as to or its agreement to submitting the lesser non-included offenses.
In this third instance, they went into his competency again?
In the third instance, I'll get exactly, it's the trial court asked him several questions about whether he'd been able to understand the things that had occurred that day. So he said...
as part of the Curtis advisement.
Right, during the Curtis advisement in this lesser non-included discussion.
And he asked him if he'd had anything to drink during lunch.
Yes. Yes, he also did ask that.
Which he didn't say he did not.
And he said he did not, yes. And he asked him to repeat and explain what he'd said about being able to use his prior convictions against him when he testified. And the court asked him to follow everything.
That's true.
Okay.
But let's assume he had sobered up during a portion of the evidence. Does that mean he was competent earlier? In other words, the later indications he may have been competent at the end of the trial do not necessarily preclude him being incompetent at the beginning of the trial, do they?
No, I agree. That's true. I think they all go to show that he was competent throughout. And then I did have other arguments about prejudice, and they found that what was there, and I think it's relevant to that inquiry as to when he became incompetent, whether he was incompetent throughout the entire proceedings or not. And one thing I note there is that the prosecution and the defendant did not rest until the next day, and the defendant then would have had an opportunity to consult with defense counsel and make any record or recall witnesses if he thought there was further cross-examination, call any witnesses. And they did not do that second day after. He would have been competent and able to consult with defense counsel on those issues. I see him out of time. If there are no further questions, the people would ask this court to affirm the judgment and conviction. Thank you.
Okay, so I just wanted to briefly address the fact that the bona fide doubt standard is a low standard. It's very similar to probable cause. It's also phrased as a reasonable cause or whether a reasonable judge would experience doubt about competency. And then I wanted to move on to the continuance issue. We had talked earlier about the preservation, and I looked back at the record a little bit just now. In terms of the continuance, I think that the record is a little unclear because the parties initially approached the bench and talked about the issue off the record. But I think if you look at pages 104 and 105, it becomes pretty clear that what they're really talking about here is continuing the trial. For example, defense counsel says, there's no question that he's intoxicated. I don't understand why the court is not agreeing. I'm ready to continue to go forward, but I don't, he doesn't say that. I'm ready to continue to go forward, period. I don't think it's fair. And then he raises the due process issue. And then the court asks the DA for his position, and the DA says he agrees with the factual representations of defense counsel. He was actually the one who brought it up and asked for the PBT to be conducted. He's concerned about the defendant's mental state. And then he says, if the court is satisfied that he's able to go forward, and that is the ruling of the court, then I'm prepared to go forward today. So it's clear that what they're all talking about is whether they should continue and go forward or whether they should wait for Mr. Proctor to sober up.
Well, on that point, mean, his intoxication was clearly self-induced.
Correct.
Why does he have a right to disrupt the proceedings by his voluntary behavior?
Well, I think that he has a right to be present at trial and to be competent at his trial. And the Colorado Supreme Court and the Tenth Circuit have both said that that's a right that cannot be waived by the defendant. That's in Jones.
Well, if he fled the jurisdiction, he could be tried in absentia, couldn't he?
Yes, he could be tried in absentia. You can waive your right to be present by your own conduct, but you cannot waive your right to be tried while competent. And again, that's Jones v. District Court, and that's at page 806, and also the U.S. v. Williams case from the Tenth Circuit. And I think the case of the Attorney General cited a case, People v. Price, where a defendant tried to commit suicide, and he was intentionally trying to delay the trial. And that was distinguishable from this case, because here, actually, the defendant was saying, I want to go forward. He's clearly not intentionally trying to delay the trial. It looks like I've run out of time, so I will just ask this court to reverse the convictions. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. We'll issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel are excused.